Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to another episode of the Scarlet Thread Society. It's wonderful to have you with me here tonight. As always, let's go over just a couple brief safety precautions before we get started. Lock your doors, close your windows, cover your mirrors, put down a salt circle if you feel so inclined, and maybe even say a few prayers or light some tobacco with me. With all of that out of the way, let's get started. Normally, this would be the first half of the show where we go over some spooky listener stories. It is my shame to admit that this month we have no new submissions to share. So, instead of leaving you empty-handed, if you check the show notes and the show description for this month, I will have included several links to the Storyteller Masters themselves and Art Bell Radio Archive. Please check that out for your story time fix that I was not able to provide for you this time. Remember also that if you have a story you would like to have featured, please do email it to me at pause@timelineearth.org. I would be more than willing to read it on air. Thank you. Alright, folks, welcome back. We're here with the second part of tonight's episode. I'm joined by a longtime friend and associate, Mr. Bird R. Kist. Say hello.
Hello.
Hi. I wanted to bring you on tonight because I know that you're a deeply well-read gentleman with a wide breadth and depth of knowledge in many a topic, both conventional and a little more esoteric. You're probably the most accessible generalist philosopher on the internet today.
Wow.
So I thought this might...
You need to write my eulogy. That was excellent. I don't even know what the word you used was. The world's foremost, most accessible blogger. I like that one. Okay,
close
good.
Enough, yeah.
I'm in. Close That's, enough. I'm in. As many titles as Yarvin has, why not?
Now, all you need is your crushed velvet stuffed chair like him, right? A nice
yeah,
bedazzled
right.
goblet.
Right, and a menacing cat that I can stroke.
Maybe even a laser shark and a neo-cameralist system while we're at it.
And laser shark. Yes, something like that. Man.
Huh.
Okay. So that's the expert you've brought on.
Yes. The world's foremost supervillain, Bird R. Kist.
Right. That's me.
Actually, today we're going to be talking about Christian Kabbalah, a little bit about its history, maybe a little bit about its philosophy, if you have anything to add on it. And this is the second out of three parts of my series on the history and the surface level of Kabbalistic traditions. You may have heard my discussion with Jay. Whether or not you did is not terribly pertinent, as they are self-contained discussions by and large.
Oh, I mean, I did listen to it, and also that exact thing that you talked with Jay about. I remember distinctly that there was like a Tuesday or a Thursday evening where me and Jay stayed up from like 11 until 5 in the morning discussing that. You know, just what the boys do. Boy stuff.
That is absolutely what boys do. That is the
boy stuff.
Bedrock of our friendship.
That's right.
Same
yeah.
exact bullshit. So
yeah. Yep.
Very much a dude's rock moment.
And I was interested in it. I like the philosophy of it, so I look forward to
yeah.
discussing.
So
that
I suppose our starting place should be, just when did Christianity begin to explore its own Kabbalistic traditions, right? And the period we have to go to is the medieval Renaissance, and very specifically Italy. There was a gentleman philosopher by the name of Pico de Marinola. I beg you, forgive me. Giovanni Pico della Mirandola.
One of the tribe.
Yes.
Member of the tribe.
Renowned Italian.
That's the other title that I possess. Yes. It's a renowned Italian.
Now, what's interesting about this gentleman is that he did quite a bit of ecumenical work in his day. He was particularly concerned with outreach to Jewish communities, and that's what led him into his own delving in Kabbalah. And this also laid the groundwork for a large part of Western esotericism, as he developed the Catholic and then Christian tradition of Kabbalah. He did this by taking the established principles of the Jewish Kabbalah, as was able to be conveyed to him in that day and age, and began to synergize it and point out its common teachings with doctrine of the church.
Oh, okay. So right from the start, that's actually not what I had understood the start of Kabbalah was.
Well,
so
the start of Kabbalah proper goes back many centuries before that, but so here's the deal with him, right? He was, I don't know that he was a church, but he was an intellectual within the church hierarchy, I think is perhaps the better way to put it. I don't know that he was necessarily preaching to church bodies, to parishioners, but most of his work revolved around writing. And, you know, specifically, this is kind of what he was known for, was this outreach to the Jewish communities and his work on the Kabbalah. You see, people who are familiar with him are probably familiar with the fact that while he was set to give a presentation on the Catholic synergy of Kabbalah to the Pope in Rome at the Vatican, when it was overturned overnight, his writings were banned and he was forced to disavow this work.
Whoa.
Yeah. This dude was literally on his way to Rome to give a presentation to the Pope about Kabbalah when one of the Pope's homies or the Pope himself sent a letter saying, hey, no, we need you to recant all this stuff. We'll do this some other time.
Wow. Wow. That would be pissed. I'd be like, what the fuck? We had a meeting. What are you talking about?
Yeah, well, so perhaps we should put it this way. Rather, the book itself wasn't outright banned so much as it was forced to cut out large swathes of it, redact it, change what he was saying, recant various theses he was going to present.
Man.
So there was a mutilated final version of it, but
Oh, so he had to put out like a very weak version. Oh my God, dude. You want to hear some, not to take you off topic on your own show, but do you want to hear some books that were considered heretical by the church?
I'd love to, frankly.
Les Miserables, which fucking owns. That's awesome, because I hate that book. I think it's terrible. The Hunchback of Notre Dame is considered heretical, which, again, that owns, because Victor Hugo sucks. The Three Musketeers by Alexandre Dumas. And The Political History of the Devil by Daniel Defoe. You've heard of that one, I'm sure. That's a wild
absolutely.
Book. Yeah, so that's small really funny. List. There's a lot more, but these are masterpieces of the Western canon. Like, that's crazy.
Absolutely.
Wow, I'm amazed by that. I really didn't know that. I'm here going, man, I didn't know that. I thought this seems like a big deal. It's like, no, everybody from Jean-Paul Sartre, Immanuel Kant, good, that's good. All banned. That's
that
great.
Is actually a great argument in the Vatican's favor.
Galileo, we know that guy was a faker. Anyway, yeah, so that's great. This is great stuff.
Now, this gentleman, Mr. Mirandola, died at the very young yet age of 31.
Cool. Like they found him with two arrows in the back of his head or something?
No, he died of natural causes.
Jeez. But
shortly before his death, the acceding pope, the pope who followed the one who canceled the meeting, actually did reinstate his work, though he never got a chance to present it. So he died with his work basically unknown, unrecognized, and mostly an afterthought.
Mm.
That is, until a friend and letter correspondent in Germany picked up the slack for him. Now, this gentleman went by the name of De Richelin, or Von Richelin? Johann Richelin, yep.
Okay.
And now, this gentleman was a Catholic humanist in his own right. Wikipedia will tell you that he was Pico's most important follower.
If I can interrupt, Johann, yes. You could spell that. And then R-E-U-C-H-L-I-N, Richelin.
Richelin. Yes. I'm far removed from my high school German classes, yeah.
I guess that is German, but...
Well, he came from Germany, and he has a vaguely Germanic name, so I'm guessing that's what it is.
He was born in the Black Forest. I don't really know what goes on in the Black Forest, frankly. So,
well, I'm not sure I'd want to know what's going on in the Black Forest in that time period. It's a cursed place, frankly.
Yeah, a lot of owls being burned. A lot of effigies of owls probably being burned in that forest.
To this day, even.
For sure. Mr. Richelin.
Yeah, so he more or less took up the mantle of Christian Kabbalah, such as it was. But the problem is that towards the end of his life, and after the life of Mr. Mirandola, something happened in that time frame there in the beginnings of the 16th century. And that would be the Protestant Reformation kicking off.
Yep. That happened.
So while these two gentlemen are running around trying to figure out how Jewish mysticism is connected to the Catholic faith, their work is basically entirely pushed to the margins because another supremely spectrum-y German is running around making what was considered at the times to be absurd claims about the faith.
Yeah, all of the fascination with Jewish philosophy had to move to the side when questions of whether or not the church had strayed from original Jewish philosophy comes up, oddly. So it seems to be when the useful work is being done, everybody's going to be like, actually, I'm pissed. Anyway. Oh, man. That's funny. So Martin Luther kicks it off in what, 1503? Is that what, something like that? How off am I?
Pretty off. I mean, 1503 is an important year in the Martin Luther story, but the Protestant Reformation itself fired. Yep.
1517. Okay. All right. You know what it is? Whenever I play EU4, it always fires early.
So I have seen that event fire in the game as early as 1490.
1490, dude. 1490. Yeah. Yeah.
Insane.
So, yeah. And I could tell you there's no Johannes Rieslins running around in that game as there is in this real world.
So, this gentleman, though, again, unrecognized, despite the fact that, you know, at this point the Pope was cool with it, trying to come back around on the topic of Kabbalah, is basically unknown. Though his great contribution to the art of Kabbalah is inserting Christ, you know, Jesus into the Kabbalah by transposing letters in the Hebrew spelling of it. Now, you'd think that would just make the whole thing go to shit. I certainly would, because spelling matters and names matter. But, you know.
Sure. I don't know what you even mean by transposing. What did it look like? What do you mean?
It was basically through the adding a letter and respelling the name. You would get the tetragrammaton is the term.
Isn't the tetragrammaton just that one name, Yahweh? Isn't that what
yes,
it is?
Yes, that is the name. And what I'm saying is this dude did some weird spelling and letter moving within the name to resynthesize parts of the Kabbalah.
So he tried to, he did like, maybe not numerology specifically, but one of the things he said was, I can show you that Jesus, if you just do take a few tweaks here, Jesus is Yahweh. Same.
Yes.
Same
yeah. Thing. He was doing gematriac nonsense with the name.
That's just silly because of course Jesus is Yahweh. Jesus comes from Jacob, Yaakov.
Well,
yeah.
Again, that's why this whole thing is goofy, right?
The guy didn't read Hebrew. I don't
know. Well, I mean, it's possible that he didn't.
I don't know. Well, okay. Listen, he's definitely smarter than us. And frankly, if he would have been around today, he would have been probably a shit poster of the highest degree. So who knows?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about that. So, and then after that, it more or less goes dead. Kabbalah, that is, in the Italian and Germanic Catholic world. And the tradition passes to the Anglos.
Oh, this is where it gets weird. Where, mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, isn't that always the case,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
The Anglos are the reason we can't have nice things.
Yep, that's correct, because of the Anglo Kabbalah. So is this, and tell me if I'm jumping the gun, because I'm just trying to insert my little points of knowledge here. Are we talking British Neoplatonist movement, or are we talking about before that? Like 1800s or before that?
We are talking immediately right there around the 1500s. You're talking about they'll come up again in the final part of the series when we get to Hermetic Kabbalah. But that is
fucking all those Rothschilds and shit. That's what they do. Yeah. So
it's two episodes out yet, though. The audience have to be patient before we touch that.
Oh, and I must mention, you're saying two. Actually, you're saying you have three episodes. If I may, I also have an episode where I had Anarchy Ball on. So Anarchy Ball messaged me. And he was like, I see you and Paz did an episode on alchemy. You know, I don't remember the phrases he used, but they impressed me. He was like, oh, I practiced this and I've done this and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, okay, very interesting. So I'm having on my show, which will come out on the first Friday of next month, I'm having him on, and he talks to me all about performing alchemy, and we kind of get into Kabbalah, and we kind of touch on magic and all that stuff. So in a way, there's four parts to your series, although you weren't involved in that one, but with your permission, I took a spin on it.
Of course. Well, practical alchemy has its place, and the final episode in this series, as you folks know, this is releasing here in April. That final one will be in June. For May, we are returning to the final part of the CIA declassifieds files.
Look at you. You have it all set up. You got it out there. You're ready to go. I wake up on a Tuesday and I'm like, what are we doing today?
Well, so the pattern I'm trying to set with this show, right? And here's a little meta behind the curtain for the audience.
Oh, please.
Is I'm alternating months between serious state actor, government involved nonsense and shenanigans. And then I go to, you know, sort of mysticism or actual conspiracies or the philosophies behind the scenes of these people. And I want to kind of take those. I want to go back and forth like that, right? So that people have a time to digest whatever I'm saying in a given episode. I know some people might feel like there's a little bit of tug of war, like we're going back and forth, but it really is all interconnected. And I don't want to throw too much at people at once. So that's kind of my thinking in doing
that. Makes sense. You know what I meant to ask you to cycle us back in. So 1500s Kabbalah shows up in England. Why does it start up there? I heard that and I just accepted it. I was like, oh yeah, of course, because the Anglos are crazy. But nobody, we didn't talk about why.
Well, we were absolutely going to get to that. What happens is there are two gentlemen, including one saint of the Catholic Church, who get super into this. Are you familiar with St. John Fisher?
No, not offhand.
Okay, well, John Fisher was he ended up martyred in all the nonsense around the Anglican happenings, I suppose is probably the best way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And what that ended up happening then in regards to that is he is the first person to spell Kabbalah with a C, actually, and talk about Kabbalistic principles directly in a sermon against Martin Luther. Yeah.
He got caught up?
Caught up in just all that nonsense. You know, him and Thomas More, right? They just got caught in all that stuff that was going around the foundation of the Anglican Church at the time and whether or not Henry was going to be a Catholic. And now, oh gosh, where was I? So the relevance of him, what I'm saying here is he's the first person who was like actively using it in sermons and public denunciations of the reformers. He was a correspondent of Erasmus, and via Erasmus, he was in touch via letters, plural, with the people like Reuchlin and Richlin. However we pronounce that dude's guy, the other guy we just talked about.
Reuchlin.
And several other scholars of the era. And it was after these guys all really started dying off that this just disappeared from the church. Because after that is when you get into the Counter-Reformation and people are just really too busy to bother with trying to figure this stuff out. It just goes by the wayside. It had a brief moment there in the Renaissance and then people just couldn't be bothered to talk about it anymore, right?
Okay.
At least in the Catholic and Protestant churches, you know. They just had other...
So it kind of just loses favor.
Yes, yeah. You know, after what happened to Mirandola and the fact that his works weren't published in time and he didn't receive recognition from the church in time to make the scholarship commonplace within the church, it just never really took off, right? And that is significant to the next part of it that we're going to get into here. So we have to fast forward 3-4, you know, almost 500 years past the birth of Hermetic Kabbalah, which again, we're not going to get into today. And you begin to see a resurgence across the world in Kabbalah. And you see this both in the Hermetic Kabbalah, obviously. You see it in more and more Jewish communities openly teaching and talking about Kabbalah. You see it in mystic New Age nonsense Kabbalah, which is extremely common and was all the rage for about 3 years or so in the early 2000s.
Sure. In fact, the way, Paz, actually, you're speaking about it makes it sound like a philosophy. Is that how you view it?
Well, that is one way to view it. And I did talk a little bit about that with Jay, in that there are several approaches to take. You can take it as a knowledge-seeking or a truth-finding method, and there are tools to do that, whether it be gematria or whether it's the theurgy of studying philosophy until you can, you know, attain the knowledge to become one with God, which is a pretty fallacious and silly concept, at least in my own mind. But, you know, a lot of practitioners think they can do that.
Yeah, sure.
You know, so you have that. You have the practical Kabbalah. You have the theurgistic aspects. But what I wanted to get into with this time frame jump up, and, you know, what I'm really discussing with this mini-series is really primarily the history and why it is viewed the way that it is. So while I would not call it outright a philosophy, I think that it is a set of research tools that is dressed as and treated as a philosophy. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, it does.
So where that takes us then is to the modern day, where if you ask basically any Christian, you know, whether that be Protestant or Orthodox or Catholic, they will tell you that Kabbalah is basically a heresy and that it is intrinsically Gnostic. And now that arises because, you know, the nature of Kabbalah and the way that it treats concepts does lend itself to Gnostic dualism and escaping the material plane to ascend to one with the Godhead or whatever it actually is that Gnostics believe.
Right. Yeah, whatever. Still to this day, I have never met a Gnostic who goes, yeah, this is what I just nod my head and I go, yep.
Well, I'm sure that there are plenty of real Gnostics in the world today.
Welcome.
There are dualistic faiths in the world today, like Zoroastrianism. So it's not like these are alien concepts to the world. They just are really not, they're not articulated clearly anywhere other than conspiracy talk radio and right. the occult philosophy yeah. section at Barnes & Noble.
Thousand,
so.
Yeah, 1,000%. It suffers from the pop culture problem of kind of hard to understand things. You get a very poppy, easy to explain version of it, which is, it seems to be in Kabbalah, the easy to understand explanation of it is that it forms a vision of God. Like it forms a functional vision of what God is supposed to look like, which I think is a misreading of it. I don't think that that's what it's supposed to be at all. But we can get into that and perhaps why it's viewed as a heresy when I think, you can integrate Kabbalah into any faith. It's a methodological reading, right? I mean, do you yes. agree with me there, or do you think it's a system of faith?
I think you are completely correct. That was the thrust of what I was saying earlier. It seems to me, like I cool. said, a toolkit or a set of skills for analyzing yeah. philosophy. And as mm-hmm. we can see with, or rather what I want the audience to see is how I'm going to choose to phrase this. How I want the audience to see this and what I want them to take away from this is the fact that even the Christian church itself was using these tools and these concepts up until the Reformation, until they just kind of ran out of time and patience because they had a million other things on their plate.
Huh, that's interesting. Maybe at the end of this, let's just do it right now. What, because you're like saying that, what do you think the greater implication of that is when you look at the Protestant Reformation? On the church as it was building.
Can you restate or clarify that for me?
Yeah, sure. So we have a church that's growing and building and schisming, and because people get shaken off or people decide, actually, we have the true expression, but there's this glob called the Catholic Church, and it's growing until, what did we say,
1517, when there was a second big splinter, you know, depending on how you want to treat the schism.
The great stories of how the first schism happened, where in the old days, they actually, there was some association with the fact that a bishop actually had to go and visit a church in order to excommunicate a person. Like, you couldn't simply write a bull and proclaim it, and then they would be excommunicated. Like, there was something about you had to go, and you had to, like, look at the church that you were excommunicating and shake your hands or something at it. So there's these stories of let's call them Roman Rite priests, and the Roman Rite priests are going to Alexandria and to Damascus and to all of the great centers of the church. And they're getting there, like, you know, the Orthodox priest, bishop, who comes out, or patriarch, I suppose he's referred to as, comes out and he sees the Catholic priests coming towards him to excommunicate him. And he's like, you're not firing me, I'm firing you first. And so they start shooting excommunications at one another. Like, we have to beat you to it. Like, if you excommunicate us first, then we're out. Because there's no
right,
real
first dibs sort of thing.
It's funny to think that, like, the priests are coming up and they don't have a sense of whose excommunication is going to work. So there really are stories of the priests are hiding and waiting until the patriarch is, like, visible, and then they will pop out of a bush and excommunicate him. Like, they didn't know whose excommunication would have mattered, so they figured it was first come, first serve. It's really strange.
Like a water balloon fight with implications for your immortal soul.
Yeah, right. And a water balloon fight where if you get hit with a water balloon, you go to hell. that's exactly, yeah, these are high stakes. they believe these were high stakes, right? Mm. Yeah, really wild stuff. But that's the cultural environment that you're growing up in, if you're Martin Luther, certainly. I mean, that was only from Martin Luther's perspective, what, 400 years beforehand? It's a long time, but it's mythical time. It's not completely forgettable. So it's like you're still the whole church is still built in this very tenuous power relationship. And so to get us back to it, the reformulating of the question is, if you look at Martin Luther being the disruptor for the church, because what you had said was things had to be put to the side because there's a million other problems that start popping up. Can you reformulate that statement to explain what, from your perspective, how the Protestant Reformation affected the church for the purposes of this episode. Because the one thing you said was it halted progress on this. What do you see as the big issue with halting progress on this?
Yeah, so the point I was driving at with that statement, and something that I think will hold true, is that the way these people like Mirandola and Richelin were conceptualizing this and going about this was really an outreach. Well, A, it was an outreach to Jewish communities as an evangelistic measure. And B, it was about continuing to expand the knowledge of God and as an actual theological venue for study, you know, this tradition and how it could be applied to the church's own. But then when you have what from their perspective would have been a tidal wave of heresies appearing all over Christendom, you know, all over Europe, that right. obviously would have to be quelled first. You have to heal the rifts before you can continue to grow outward. So really, it was just
because that was never healed. We're kind of stuck.
There was a holding pattern where they just couldn't continue to develop these schools of thought.
So there is. So then from the implications of that statement, and I'd want to dig into your brain on this. Does that imply that had the Protestant Reformation never happened, or had it happened but was resolved? Let's say Martin Luther didn't die on the way to the meeting that well, I forget where that
yeah,
was
supposed to happen. Yeah, if he got bushwhacked
like
on the
I think he died on the way home
the
or something.
Diet or something, yeah. You're saying.
Yeah, he died on the way home or something like that. Whatever. There was no remuneration possible. So does that mean that the primary goal, from your eyes, the primary goal of the church, if it wants to advance in theory, is that it has to first solve the Protestant Reformation problem?
Yes, I think that would be my claim, and that's what I'm getting
You're
at.
Screwed. You know how the blockchain works, right? Where you get a transaction, and then another one, and another one, another one, and then the first one's really hard to change because you got to change all the ones that happened before the first one. That's what we're dealing with.
Sure.
You have to be undoing a whole lot of stuff. But
now,
that's an interesting perspective because I sort of agree with you.
That's actually possible either, because we have seen other developments in theological thought. So it's obviously still doable.
Sure.
It's just that this one was forgotten in history despite its apparently strong viability for outreach to the Jewish communities.
Right. And you're a Lutheran, so it's not like you could be doing this right now. I'm just asking from the perspective of the largest single institution under the brand name.
Right.
Like if we were, because I really do, and again, we can get into this, but I really do view Kabbalah as a useful way to read some pretty esoteric concepts like love and things like that. I think it's useful for understanding the functional capacities of things like love, how you analyze them from a Kabbalistic perspective, or metaphysics, like space and time. How do we envision what the Big Bang looked like? Well, believe it or not, the Kabbalists were the first people that I know of who have a conception of a Big Bang that starts history.
And it does actually literally look like a Big Bang in their conceptualization of it.
That's right. So it is a useful tool for visualizing stuff, because I think when you talk, like, you can explain the Big Bang theory perhaps in physics, but that's not an illustration. You know what I mean?
Right.
It doesn't help you see it, because yeah, you can understand it, but if you don't see it, how are you going to ever tell anybody else about it? So I only ask the question because I think Kabbalah is a useful reading, and I would like to see the church doing quite a bit more bringing in outside sources and stressing that the lay people should start to make more philosophical decisions within the church. Now, I'm sure that a lot of Catholics don't agree with me there, but, you know, whatever.
Well, I'm sure my ECATH segment of the audience is about to throw
sure
a massive hissy fit, but...
Yeah, I'm sure they will. I'm sure I'm being called a heretic, and it's whatever. But the fact is, it is good to advance in my mind. And so... And to be ecumenical. And
sure.
I think you and I do a good job at that every day.
Absolutely,
we have lots of conversations about it. We seem to agree on most things, including the very important dogmas. And so it's interesting to hear, if you want to be really effective, you're doubly incentivized to be ecumenical, because what's on the line is having a global community of people who can start using new methodologies for updating how you communicate the faith to people in a world that's too obsessed with, you know, porn and candy to care.
That is precisely right on every level, and I'm really glad you've been able to phrase it so eloquently.
that's where I'm at with it, and I have been for a few years. But I that all started from me asking about the implications of it, but I think that was me interrupting you. So please, you can take us back if you want.
Well, the truth of the matter is I'm not sure where we were at before I even, before you asked me a question. So
I know, you know, on my own show, I'm comfortable to just be like, we'll start with a topic and then I don't care if we finish it. But on other shows, I'm like, man, I don't want to do what I do. You know, I don't want to do me and just ruin everybody's like, man, we got to talk about Christian Coblin. By the episode, we're talking about Barney the dinosaur.
Well, look, dinosaurs are a whole nother matter that will be discussed. But
that's right. Which Coblin can't explain, but neither can science.
That's correct. So I think where we were at was discussing the modern church's conception of it as a Gnostic heresy, because they are on the surface level so similar. And if you treated Kabbalah as a coherent philosophy of its own, it would indeed seem to be more Gnostic than it would anything else. But as I've tried to establish by discussing the timeline of it, at least specifically within the Catholic Church with you here, is that if you understand it the way the people in the time when it was being actively researched understood it, you would see that it is more of a toolkit than it is anything else.
So to clear up the idea that it is Gnostic, I wouldn't, first of all, I would reject the idea that Kabbalah, and not because I'm saying you said this, but anybody who thinks that Kabbalah is inherently Gnostic, historically, I don't believe that's the case. I think it's absolutely historically the case that it is a monastic practice and that it actually turns into a Gnostic practice in the early church. I think it's I would suppose that the earliest practices of mystic Judaism are absolutely monotheistic, in fact. So
that's beyond historically, even any kind of reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
Yes.
So historically, I would say there's no basis to claim Kabbalah is inherently dualistic. And if that's the case, then we can simply say that the dualism is a result of a misunderstanding of the original thing. So I'm comfortable pushing that to the side so that we can talk about what a monastic Kabbalah would look like. So remember, this is all illustrative. And I think people, when they hear philosophy, they think it should be mathematical. And it's not. None of these people intended it to be mathematical. It's all illustrative. It's all esoteric. If you understand what esoteric knowledge is, it's simply encoded knowledge, encoded because it is impossible at the present time when it is being encoded to decode sufficiently. So they write it out and they go, hopefully people can, you know, put these thoughts together when there's more of an understanding of what's going on. I mean, that's how esotericism seems to work. So now if you understand that, what I would try and clear up is there's one conception in Kabbalah that runs up against dualism, and it's what is dualism? The idea of good and evil. Specifically, dualism in the Gnostic sense is unique. For example, you mentioned Zoroastrianism. Zoroastrianism is a monotheistic religion in that evil comes out of good. The same thing occurs in the Old Testament. The tree, or the ladder, whatever you want to call it, the descending light. Is, remember that the creation of the universe and the image of God is a light, is just light. The only thing they use to describe him is light, is a formless but absolute overpowering light. Now, that's not literal, obviously, because light is made out of photons and God is not made out of photons. It is simply an expression. And the expression is meant to communicate that if you have a light shining, there's going to be a penumbra at the edge of the light. Or I don't even know if penumbra is the right word. I think it might be, but maybe umbra is the right word. The ring of darkness around the light. And in the Kabbalic conception, if you move the light, right, if you move it around, there's a void that you leave behind called darkness. If you think about, if you're into circuitry and computer science, if you know about the concept of hole flow, which is when an electron moves in one direction, energy moves in the opposite direction. The hole that the electron leaves as it moves is called is where the electricity is. That's where the current is running. If you want to think about it that way, you can do the very same thing. The Kabbalic expression of good and evil is that, first of all, I would argue it doesn't say that God is absolute good. It just says God is absolute knowledge. It doesn't say he's good. I think we insert a lot of good and evil on God when we really should not be doing that. And we should be measuring good and evil based on God and not our own conceptions of him.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is a huge, huge major. I don't know where that came from, but I think that's a 1700s, 1800s Enlightenment era understanding of God, because most of history never said, I'm a God lover. They said, I'm a God fearer. And they said that for a reason.
Right.
So I don't think there's any promises in a true Christian expression, Catholic expression, which says God is good in any human sense. God is good because he's the ultimate mover and we're getting to the end goal with him. That's what good is. Good means in accordance with the plan. So if you think about exactly that idea, good is in accordance with the plan. To be out of accordance with the plan is to be evil, or to be like a light bulb shining wherever it moves away from, there's darkness left. That's the evil. The good goes with the light. It moves with the light. This is not a conception of good and evil exist together in equal power. No, no, no. In Kabbalah, evil is literally the lurking, gross shadow of good. Wherever there is not good, there is evil. This is not to say that the good and the evil for some reason are of equal power. That's dualism, right? That's heretical. Right. Is that good and evil either created one another? No, no, no. In any Christian expression from Paul Tillich's Lutheranism to John Paul II, or actually Duns Scotus's Catholicism, to Baruch Spinoza's atheism, there's an idea of God that is way higher than any human being's reading of moral good and evil. And I always have fallen into that. And so my dismissal of Kabbalah is inherently dualistic is historically, I don't think that's the case. And then secondarily, but more importantly, the illustration that Kabbalah gives is just not dualistic in any sense. So that's how I would try and clear that up. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense to me. And I full well believe that my audience is educated and wise enough to understand your point as well.
I would hope so. I know I'm being roasted in at least one group chat, but that's okay. It's all right.
So I would then say, and we need to wrap up in the next 10 minutes or so, I think,
sure.
Just due to my obligation that we talked about. But I would say that the only attack vector that is really has any real surface on Kabbalism for Christianity, and in fact, you already just addressed it right there, is the idea that Kabbalah does in fact perceive God as being sort of an uncaring and above, a font of all knowledge and something to be connected to, and that Christians don't necessarily understand God in that way, especially not anymore, though perhaps actually they should.
The only addendum to what you had said was, you can believe that if you want, but for me, I would say, in the unfolding of history is God's caring.
Absolutely.
History unfolds, you know what I mean? The fact that history is unfolding is God's care. Like, because if God didn't care, we are dust.
Sure.
You know what I mean? If he said, I'm not interested anymore, we just turn it to dust and that's it. And it's over. So at least for me, and probably, then seems like for you too, I would not mistake caring or interest with good or bad. I definitely think, in fact, God's primary thing is interest.
Well,
it seems as if
he
God
as much
and
as
his
tells
plan
us so directly and repeated
seems
yes.
to be the case. Seems to be the case is that the whole thing is God is the plan. God is the plan unfolding as much as God is the writer of the plan. At least that's how I have tried to rationalize it in an illustrative way. Again, I don't think any of this has theological stakes. I mean, unless the illustration points you in a bad direction, which I'm trying not to, but I don't think most of this has theological stakes. It's a matter of trying to communicate it to one another. Like if you have a monotheistic principle, you have to just communicate that.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like it's hard to go, well, I'm a monotheist, but also the devil is a threat to God. Well, then, you know, you're not really a monotheist.
Sure.
But if you go, God is the plan. Anything outside of that is bad and definitely not a threat to it. You're kind of a monotheist,
right?
Right. So, right. Your Tawhid is good. You're upholding it. Everything is good for everybody.
Yeah. So I would, the actual existence of Christian Kabbalah is more a question of what if than it is anything else. But it is the fact that these gentlemen were willing to explore it
right.
for themselves, and the fact that it was being actively developed before being set aside, that really will set me up for the final part of this discussion when we examine who the Hermetic Kabbalists were and what they are and what they chose to believe.
Did you, at any point while you were doing this, think that you were going to get really creepy with it? Or do you think that there's just nothing too creepy about Kabbalah?
I think that all of the creepiness will be contained in what the fat-brained Hermetic Cretans made of it
okay.
in the 17 and 1800s.
Yes, that is
the creep is yet to come,
yes.
folks.
Yes.
Please just bear with me while I set all of this up
right.
for you. I promise you it's been a slow sizzle for a big payoff coming in June.
That's why I asked you, because when you talk about Kabbalah, clearly there's and I don't know if it's a, and I'm not saying this to, you know, be a very tiresome person, but I wonder if the rejection of Kabbalah is a very latent cultural anti-Semitism, or if it's less important than that. And it's just, it's weird. I don't get it. Why are people so against it? Did it come from there? Or is it really Christians doing Kabbalah where it started to become a big poo-poo? We can't have that. You know what I mean? I don't know where it originated
from. I can't say. I just really can't. But I think you can make a very good case for either of those specifically. And I'm sure there's a dozen more instances
probably.
Ways of looking at
and
it.
And the tendency within the Catholic Church, probably for good reason, considering how many schisms there's been, although I think it's a cyclical thing where the more you tighten up, the more schisms you provoke, which... I don't know. We could probably have been having that conversation for 2,000 years. But I think that there's a lot of room to discuss Kabbalah within the church. Like, I think there's a lot of use for it in the church. And I will say, to me, the most important thing is getting people back in and getting the sacrament on their tongue. And I don't care about, you know what I mean? I don't care about other, whatever illustration you need to use for these people to wholeheartedly understand and accept the sacrament that they're taking. Amazing. Wonderful. I don't care. If it's a painting or an illustration, that's great. Whatever we got to do. Because I think this world, the world that we live in right now, is bereft of religion. Even though there seems to be a lot of religion going around, it seems to be bereft of an authentic religion. Because perhaps the way we look at the world today is out of line with the way that the established religions are looking at the world, which is a matter of updating and not the fact that the religions have to be abandoned or that the current world has to be abandoned. But we do hermeneutics like we do for literally everything else. We go, okay, the world is this today and the world was that then. What are the discrepancies? How do we grapple with them? And what's the future supposed to look like when we do that? That's obviously the way forward with probably everything. And as somebody who's really interested in getting the church to grow in size and in intellect, I'm very interested in opening up the doors for more methodological understandings of this big, hard to explain concept of a monotheistic God and a church underneath it. So that's my long way of saying, I think this is really important. And it needs to be looked into more as a methodology and an illustration for explaining our faith.
I think that is the perfect note to wrap up on. So just let me ask you, before we stop recording here, is there anything you'd like to show to the people who listen to me and might not listen to you?
Check out, if you haven't, if you're into politics, if you're a libertarian or an anarchist or anything like that, check out my series on Free Man Beyond the Wall, Pete Quinones. Start with the episode on Lenin. Just Google Free Man Beyond the Wall, Birdarchist, Lenin, and it'll take you to that. And then by the end of those episodes, you'll maybe hopefully know something about Marxism if you didn't.
Hell yeah.
Okay. Thank you for having me on, man. Thank you for getting spooky.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having this discussion with me.
Hell yeah. Do you have a sign out? I never get to the end of any podcast. Do you have a sign out?
I do not have an actual sign out. I just play my intermission music a second time at the end.
Have you ever tried to make a sign out? Like, have you ever like been like, I'm going to slip the sentence in and hopefully nobody notices it's unusual?
You know what? I have rehearsed about a dozen in my brain and none of them just ever sounded right, right. So I never went with it.
Right. You know, you have to, just like with a nickname, you can never give your own sign off to yourself. You know what I mean? Like someone else has to be using it and you have to take it from them or they have to suggest it to you. That should be a 2021 goal, is that your podcast, you come up with an outro, because every good radio guy has an outro that you probably can remember, like to your bones.
No doubt.
Art Bell's was, oh fuck, jeez, now I'm blowing myself up because I don't know, but oh,
but he had one.
He did.
Yeah.
I'm gonna play it. That's what I'll do. Yeah, I got it. But yeah, we need a sign off. We got to come up with sign offs, Boz. That's my challenge to you.
You know what? I think we could probably do that. I'll hold a Twitter competition.
Ooh, not a bad idea. Come up with four, put a poll out. Which sign out do you want to hear? And then just do it and then see if it feels good. And then if it doesn't feel good, don't do it for the next episode.
Right. Yeah,
that's how you do it. Just experiment. Mm. But thank you for having me on. And
thank you, Bird. Have a wonderful night. Happy birthday.
Thank you, Squaw.